At least audio. Audio.
Are we ready for the? Are we ready for the? Is this on? Okay. Thank you, everyone. Is this on? Well, welcome, everybody. It's ABA days. Legal Services Corporation Board is having a meeting here. See, the mic is not working. No, it's not done. It's on?
Mm-hmm.
Well. Okay. Well, welcome everybody to the Legal Services Corporation. It's a special day or week in Washington. It's ABA days. The Friends of Legal Services Board is meeting here, and the Legal Services Board itself is beginning its meeting here and then going on down to Richmond, Virginia for a visit to Virginia. And, well, what a special day for us to have Larry Tribe come down to be with us. He's a giant in the field of constitutional law, one of the boldest, most authoritative voices I've heard on why access to justice is critical for our clients, our courts, and our nation. An outstanding legal scholar, and by the way, a Harvard Law professor who knows how to shape up his students to go on to greater things, like Barack Obama, John Roberts, and Elena Kagan. Larry, thank you for taking the time. I know this wasn't so easy for you to fit into your schedule to be with us today. As Senior Counselor for Access to Justice in the Department of Justice, Larry launched last year a multifaceted program to increase legal access for low-income and middle-class Americans. His efforts have resonated with people across the country, particularly at LSC programs and at the highest levels of the government. While he was a law clerk for Potter Stewart at the U.S. Supreme Court, has argued 35 cases before the Supreme Court, authored American Constitutional Law, a major treatise in the field, while he holds the highest academic honor that Harvard can give to a professor, that of university professor, let me assure you, he's not a man completely captive of high places and ivory towers. Shortly after taking up his post last year at the Justice Department, Larry volunteered for short-term pro bono representation in D.C., providing free legal help at a Saturday clinic. He is, in every sense, a consummate public servant. Last year, LSC was privileged to participate in a White House event on expanding access to legal services that was organized by Larry and his staff, many of whom are here with us today. In fact, why don't you guys stand up? There you are, yeah. At that event, as many of you will recall, my presentation focused on LSC's initiative to create an awareness and referral network among LSC programs and the VA's Veterans Readjustment Counseling Centers to minimize the frustrations that veterans and military families often encounter when seeking assistance for civil legal problems, whether it involved housing, child custody, or employment. LSC also funded a new national website, statesidelegal.org, which was officially launched at the November event. And since that time, I'm happy to report the website has had more than 20,000 unique visitors from all 50 states and 90 countries and has recorded 101,267, boy, that's precise, page views of information. So it is fitting that in addition to all of us assembled here, Larry will be speaking via the internet to our programs across the country. As everyone here knows, Larry is a tireless supporter of the Legal Services Corporation. While at the Department of Justice, he worked to support increased funding for OSC, increase the use of technology to improve legal services and self-help solutions, and to expand access to justice commissions to every state, and to engage and reward the pro bono bar. Larry's determination to never give up on equal access to justice and to help call attention across the country to the serious issues that are affecting our country in its fulfillment of its national pledge are an inspiration to me, and I'm sure to everyone else in this room. It is my honor and privilege to introduce to you Lawrence H. Trott.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. It's an honor and a privilege for me to be here. And I feel very much like I'm coming home, not because I've actually been at the LSC building before. I haven't. But seeing Maha and Malanka and Dan and Debbie and Karen, my amazing staff, only one of them is not here. She's Lynn and she's in New Orleans at the moment. Seeing so many old friends makes me feel very much at home. And the other thing that just absolutely blows my mind is that if I look over there, I see the place, literally see the place where I lived when I was in Washington while I was at DOJ. It was right on Katie's Alley, across the canal from LSC, but I didn't know that you were here, and I guess you didn't know I was there. It's amazing. It sort of reminds me in a way of the fact that when I first got to my position in the Justice Department, one of the first things that I did was watch John and Martha Minow and some of the other new members of the board be sworn in. And that afternoon, we had a brief meeting, and I was told that it was really the first time that the Justice Department and the LSC had actually met in all of the years that the Legal Services Corporation was in existence. I mean, there was a kind of wall of separation, not between church and state, but between justice and justice. Very strange. Well, you're all familiar, I think, with the problems that led to the decision by the President and by the Attorney General to ask me to create an initiative on access to justice at DOJ last March. Enormously well-documented studies in recent years had made clear that justice in the very broad practical sense, ensuring that people have a meaningful opportunity to receive fair and equal treatment under the laws and programs that are there to protect them, is much more an aspiration than it is a reality, not only for the working poor and for those entirely left behind in our economy, but also for the struggling middle class, many of whom are just barely hanging on by their fingernails to avoid falling into the abyss. I think you're also all aware, it's a value that brings us all together here, that justice in this practical sense, both criminal and civil, is critical to democracy, is critical to our moral leadership in the world, critical to our claim that we differ from tyrants and terrorists and to our sense of who we are as a nation. Believing those things profoundly, both the President and the Attorney General were and remain dedicated to deepening and broadening our understanding of the magnitude and the causes of that justice gap and of how to be smarter in attacking it, to making real headway and reducing the size of that gap at a time when economic resources are under tremendous strain, making the gap simultaneously harder to close and more damaging to everything that we stand for. In the budget deal that is awaiting a vote, I guess, tomorrow, the 2011 LSC budget, you all know better than I do, would suffer a $30.8 million cut from the amount the White House requested for 2011, representing a reduction of something like $15.8 million from the numbers for the year 2010, with an average cut of 3.8% in current grants to the 136 LSC-funded programs. Now, that comes on top of the terrible cutbacks that the programs are enduring as a result of the dramatic reduction in IOLTA funds caused by lower interest rates and by diminished real estate transactions. You have a better sense than I do of how many rural offices will have to be shut down as a result, how many staff attorneys will have to be laid off, how many more low-income people will end up receiving little or no civil legal assistance nationwide. The good news is that the situation is not nearly as dire as it would have been under the continuing resolution that the House, but not the Senate, passed on February 19th. The bad news, of course, is that the situation is still, frankly, terrible. When I was tapped late in 2009 to create a new office to address these enormously challenging issues with a very lean budget, enough to hire just 6 senior lawyers and 1 office manager, with no grant-making or regulatory authority, that is, no power of the purse and no power of the sword, I took a few months to survey the landscape before my appointment became official last March. And I concluded very early in the process that the only way I could hope to make any dent at all in such a huge set of problems with such limited resources, despite all of the energy and the talent of the staff that was assembled to work with me, and without any real power, was to make my office a focal point for linking up and encouraging existing efforts, highlighting those that were working well, identifying and disseminating best practices, partnering with other agencies within the government, including, as it turned out, Commerce, Labor, Veterans Affairs, and the Vice President's Middle Class Task Force, coordinating with key entities outside the government, including, of course, LSC, legal aid organizations, IOLTA programs, bar associations, law schools, legal clinics, public defenders' offices, access to justice commissions, the National Center for State Courts, the Self-Represented Litigation Network hosted by the NCSC and the National Conference of State Chief Justices, among others, and operating as a kind of bully pulpit from which to stimulate others to undertake needed changes. Changes like those that might eventually relax unwise prohibitions on the unauthorized practice of law and other constraints that get in the way of delivering affordable legal services within existing budget constraints. Now, I should say that operating a bully pulpit within the constraints of the vetting that has to happen whenever you give a speech representing the administration, this was true not only of the Obama administration, but of all its predecessors, was, let me say, interesting. You know, as an academic who had been used to shouting off his mouth and saying what he thought in testimony and in speeches, suddenly to learn that, you know, every cabinet department and the White House had to sign off on every word was an interesting experience, an interesting exercise. And I was sort of wondering on the plane on the way down here whether I should take advantage of the new freedom that I have in order to sort of let it rip and say some remarkably radical thing. But actually, I don't have anything remarkably radical to say at the moment, because the observations that I have about the magnitude of the problems we face are unfortunately commonplace. And all I can do is describe to you the struggles that we went through, what we tried to do, and hope that you will all take the ball from there. I'm sure you're all familiar with how IOLTA became much less useful as a funding source as interest rates plummeted. One of the things that my staff at Justice took on was working with the Department's Office of Legislative Affairs, and with the ABA and other allies, to promote passage of the bill extending FDIC insurance for IOLTA accounts, preserving the second largest source of civil legal services funding. I wish we could boast of some similar success with respect to the single largest source, the LSC appropriation, but I'm afraid that that was a tougher hill to climb than we were able to climb. There are possibilities outside the current IOLTA LSC box. They, however, are truly radical. They involve things that are on the horizon but not immediately accessible, ideas like perhaps a tax on legal services, to increase funding levels dramatically and permanently. They were, in a way, part of the very long-term agenda that my office urged people to take seriously, but they were not viable in the near term. One of the things that impressed me the most as my office got going was how many unmet legal needs don't necessarily require the conventional full engagement of licensed lawyers, but can be addressed through better utilization, both of lawyers on discrete, unbundled tasks that only lawyers can perform, coupled with much fuller utilization of bright people, college students, graduates without law degrees, but with more specialized training, to assist people in navigating the system on their own, aided by courts and court personnel better equipped with the assistance of user-friendly websites and personal attention, to lead people through what is too often a mysterious maze of specialized procedures that could use not only clearer explanation but more outright simplification. In a way, the problem of the poor in accessing legal services is like the canary in the coal mine. That is, it reveals a problem with the entire legal system, its opacity, its unnecessary complexity. We have a language, we lawyers, and we like to keep it rather obscure and arcane so that we understand it and we can speak it to one another. It's not all necessarily intentional, but there is a dynamic in each profession that gravitates toward complexity, toward what amounts to a kind of elite monopoly over things that really ought to be simpler. And in the end, what the legal system as a whole needs more of is accessibility, transparency, simplicity, so that it's not an obstacle course, but an open door. Indeed, speaking of open doors, next to my door at the Department of Justice, and there's a photograph of it that my staff gave me when I left, there was this sign, Access to Justice, and people would stop by that sign and kind of marvel that there was finally a place that focused on that value within the U.S. Department of Justice. In any event, my initiative worked with groups around the country, including judges, administrative personnel, to encourage best practices in the direction of simplification, in the direction of openness. One of the things I remember most fondly was that, I think it was with Debbie, I went to one of the, I don't know if this was in the state court or the federal court in the Central District of California, but it was in California, and they had a really terrific program of helping people who were self-represented litigants, who really couldn't access lawyers even with the best efforts of pro bono activity by law firms, LSC, LSC grantees. And then they had this sign, and this I saw a guy kind of wandering around. The sign said, unrepresented litigants. Was that it, unrepresented litigants? And I thought, does this guy really know that that's the line he's supposed to stand in? Why couldn't it just say, people without lawyers? And so we got them to agree to make that simple change. And I've certainly checked that they made that change. They sent us a photograph of what it now looks like. I don't know how much difference it made, but small things can sometimes make large differences. I think that's one of the many areas in which I would imagine the LSC could use its management and grants compliance appropriation and its appropriation for technology innovation, not only to influence the activities of its grantees, but also to help shape the environments in which those grantees operate, help simplify those environments, help remove unnecessary obstacles. Speaking of those environments, another thing that impressed me was how eager many law firms are to tap the unused resources of senior lawyers, really talented, experienced lawyers, who aren't ready to be put out to pasture, but are dramatically underutilized as mentors for younger lawyers who can get better litigation and transactional experience through suitable temporary placements in pro bono contexts than they can within the conventional confines of work billed by the hour in law firms that can no longer make effective use of new associates in the traditional lockstep way. In the emerging business models of many law firms, they can't get their clients to pay $200 or $300 an hour or more for people fresh out of law school. These people fresh out of law school, therefore, can't get direct, hands-on client experience. One obvious way of matching that available resource with unmet needs is to help channel and funnel those young lawyers into pro bono programs and into services programs, public services, legal services, supervised by more seasoned and senior partners who otherwise are really underutilized. That kind of matching of available resources with unmet needs is something that we observed as a possibility throughout the country, and something that I think the LSC could encourage as part of its, not its direct work with grantees, although I think there are ways of leveraging that work to facilitate and encourage this kind of matching, but as part of its broader effort to affect the environment. I'm particularly delighted and proud in that respect that your co-chair and my good friend and dean, Martha Minow, is going to be chairing the new pro bono task force that the LSC launched last week to help low-income Americans facing foreclosure, domestic violence, other serious civil legal programs. Although law firms are doing somewhat more pro bono work than some people give them credit for, much of that work is scattered and insufficiently focused. I mean, people doing, you know, extra hours here or there without signature projects that really are conceptualized in a way that can make a significant difference is not really the way to go. There are firms that have focused their efforts in particular projects in various communities, sometimes in the United States, sometimes outside. And the amount of untapped resource that's there in these law firms at a time when public resources and taxes are not generally available to solve the problem shouldn't be underestimated. I was at the 25th, 40th, and 50th, and I guess 5th and 10th reunions of Harvard classes in Cambridge the other day, and I kept running into senior partners of big firms on the West Coast and on the East Coast who talked about the tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, that could be unleashed if only people were to zero in on the pro bono potential of those firms. Now, how exactly to do that is something I was struggling with during the less than 10 months that I was in my office, but it's something that I know that the people who are still there are going to be paying a lot of attention to. During the relatively brief time that I was in Washington, we particularly focused, and the staff that was working with me are still focusing on the legal needs of the most vulnerable populations, including immigrants, juveniles, the homeless, disabled veterans, victims of domestic and sexual violence. And given the limits on what the office could do on its own, and I stress it has no grant-making authority and it can't issue orders, it necessarily has to work closely with other governmental and private entities, federal, state, local, and tribal, to create partnerships with those who do have access to funds, stimulus funds, and other sources of capital that we could nudge in the direction of reducing the size of the justice gap. So, for example, we worked with the NTIA, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, in the Commerce Department, to direct broadband grants to projects in the states of Washington and North Carolina to assist people in rural areas and in disadvantaged urban areas, including Indian tribes in Washington and minorities in North Carolina, to help them gain better access to legal and other services that would otherwise be beyond their reach. We didn't have a grant to do it. The Commerce Department did. We scoured around the government. We found that as a possible place to link up. We worked with the Department of Housing and Urban Development and with innovative courts around the country that are pioneering the use of mediation to cope with those home foreclosures that are avoidable or to mitigate the impact of foreclosures that turn out to be unavoidable for the nearly 8 million American households that are at risk of losing their homes. We worked with the Office of the Vice President and the Office on Violence Against Women in the Justice Department to create and expand partnerships between law school clinics, legal services providers, and law firms to extend comprehensive services to victims of domestic violence. We worked to facilitate partnership involving the Labor Department, bar organizations, and I think the LSC was involved in this one as well, but I'm not sure, to help prevent workers from being deprived by misclassification as independent contractors when they're really employees, to help them avoid various forms of wage theft that deprive them of the wages and benefits to which they're entitled. One of our most challenging efforts had to do with increasing access to counsel for immigrants involved in removal proceedings, especially those who are most in need of help, including those with mental disabilities and unaccompanied minors, about 8,000 of whom are detained annually by immigration officials. Now, I'm sure that it won't come as a surprise to you how much difference it makes for people in that circumstance to have legal help. Our immigration laws, speak of labyrinthine and complex, are among the most complex out there. Turns out that immigrants seeking asylum in the United States to avoid persecution and torture in their home countries are three times as likely to win their claims if they are represented by an attorney as if they are not. And to give you just one concrete example of how difficult progress in areas like that can prove to be, even apart from the obvious political resistance on the Hill to getting new laws passed, and certainly the overwhelming resistance in this era obsessed with cutting budgets, to getting new appropriations, to give you just one concrete example, there was a 1995 memorandum written by the General Counsel of Immigration and Naturalization Services that read a pair of federal statutes to mean that otherwise available federal dollars could never be used to provide legal representation to immigrants in removal proceedings, even if the Attorney General concluded in his discretion that it was in the interest of justice and in the interest of the United States to provide such representation at government expense. I mean, it might ultimately save the government more money, that it would end up using warehousing people who have no business being detained. It took the entire time that I was here in Washington, nearly all of 2010, to persuade the executive branch to reverse its interpretation of those two statutes, an interpretation that seemed to me demonstrably incorrect. I mean, here I was. I wasn't totally naive. I had done some work helping other countries write constitutions. I had done some consulting. I had advised the president. I taught the president. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a total newcomer. But if you had asked me how, almost the first day I got there, I read this interpretation, I said, you got to be kidding. If somebody had asked me, how long will it take to get this undone? And if someone had said 10 months, I would have said, that's impossible. It's inconceivable. And in the end, it was undone not because of the progressive Justice Department under a wonderful Attorney General. It was done because someone in Homeland Security was helpful to us. So things are tough. It's not an excuse for how little we got done. I do think we planted seeds. They're going to grow. They'll grow with your help. But don't underestimate, I guess, I'm speaking to the choir if I say to you, don't underestimate how hard it is to do the simplest things. There were a lot of initiatives we began while I was there that my staff is continuing to develop now that I'm back at Harvard. Thank God. I mean, if I had to leave and think that all that was going to get done was what I could get done in the 10 months that I was there, it would have been very depressing. But seeing these talented, energetic people stand up just is very heartening to me. They're working on ways of eventually lifting some of the unwarranted restrictions on groups funded by the LSC. That's a tough lift, but may not be impossible. They're working with the National Conference of State Chief Justices, whom we persuaded last year to adopt a resolution encouraging the 25 or so states that do not yet have access to justice commissions to form such commissions. There was a resolution that was adopted shortly after I addressed the national conference, and it's now being implemented. Half a dozen more states are now in the process of creating access to justice commissions, which do tend to be very powerful focal points for energetic change within the states. They've been vital in making improvements. I think Kansas recently announced the launch of an ATJ committee, and Connecticut is getting closer to launching one. So a lot is being done. The White House, I'm glad to say, has been identifying a short list of candidates for the Justice Department to consider as my successor as senior counselor for access to justice. I'm hopeful that someone will be named within a very short time. It's an initiative that has a huge amount of work to do, work that's even more necessary in a time of tight budgets. But whatever the Access to Justice initiative in the Department of Justice accomplishes, I think it's important for you to recognize that the work that you and the LSC are doing and facilitating is absolutely indispensable to preventing the justice gap from degenerating into a justice crisis. What you do is vital to the nation and its ideals, and I'm honored that you invited me to talk with you, and I hope that we can have some conversation with a little Q&A. Thank you very, very much.
Questions,
if there are questions, suggestions, thoughts, yes, Kathleen.
Would it be possible to do more to interest students, law students, in pro bono work if you used more mock trials using legal services instead of some big grand case?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the hunger among law students is palpable. And one of the things that I saw in visiting law schools around the country is that law students are genuinely eager to have those experiences. Some faculty would be eager to provide them. And there are some law firms in the community that have some ideas. And there are often legal services offices nearby, but it's a matter of pulling them all together. And I'm not sure how much the LSC can do to help facilitate that. But one of the things that my initiative tried to do, and they're going to, I don't know, has that law school conference at Stanford occurred yet, or is it about to?
It has occurred.
It has occurred. Well, I can't report on it since I wasn't there. But there has been a conference that had as its focus what can be, how legal education can be tweaked in various ways, both in terms of its curriculum and in terms of what the clinics do and in terms of how moot courts and mock trials are put on. To take the energy, the enthusiasm that students bring to law school and harness it in some of these efforts. So that's definitely one of the things that's on the horizon. I think it helps that your co-chair, the co-chair of your board of directors, is working with John in that direction. Martha Minow has a deep commitment to moving legal education. She sometimes thinks that we should think of these not so much as schools of law, although they are also that, but also as schools of justice. Yes?
Professor Tribe, it's nice to meet you in person. I'm on the board. I'm Victor Maddox from Louisville.
Hi, Victor.
And, of course, I studied with your case law book and all of that 30 years ago, so.
Don't make me feel that old.
Well, it was probably a new edition in 1978. I'm intrigued by your suggestion that it would be a good idea to remove the restrictions that are currently in place on LSC. This is, you know, an issue that John is smiling because I raise it often, and I'm usually in the minority when I do, I think. But I, you know, we saw in the 80s, you know, LSC was a highly politicized organization, and in the 90s, there was more of that, I guess, from the first few years of the Clinton administration. And then when the Republicans took over Congress, we got the 96 restrictions that were part of a slicing of LSC's funding by 50% or so. And I think all of that was a reaction to, you know, the sort of give and take between administrations year after year to the sort of either the presence or absence of restrictions. And it seems that in the last 15 years or so, a lot of the political element of LSC has been, if not eliminated, at least, you know, leavened substantially. And I just wonder if it is counterproductive ultimately to take those restrictions out.
Well, I right, Victor, I'm not suggesting kind of suddenly wiping out all of the restrictions, saying it doesn't matter whether it's abortion or prisoners or immigrants or whatever, go to it. But some of the restrictions are less politically volatile than others. The restriction on bringing class actions, for example. I mean, it may be that some people have in their head that class actions are necessarily leftist operations, but that's not necessarily the case. And I was working while I was at Justice on a white paper, I don't know if it's yet seen the light of day, I hope it someday will, on how some of the restrictions on what LSC grantees can do with non-LSC money are themselves deeply counterproductive. They lead to inefficiencies. They make it much harder to use the legal process to support and to advance the causes of people whose individual injuries may be rather small. And at least exploring that, it seems to me very much worthwhile. I mean, I understand that some people from time to time have thought that there is a trade-off between removing restrictions and keeping appropriations in place, that the restrictions are a kind of shield against accusations of partisanship and politicization. And I'm not suggesting that there is nothing in those concerns, but I'm only suggesting that one of the avenues that ought to be explored and that shouldn't be regarded as forever off the table is a relaxation of some of the restrictions, especially restrictions on the use of non-LSC money by grantees. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Julie Risk, and I'm also on the Legal Services Board, and I've loved everything
Julie.
You said. I was especially interested in what you were talking about using non-attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Colorado, and the organization I direct, a nonprofit, the Colorado Cross Disability Coalition, we do that. We train volunteer advocates to do administrative law judge work.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, do you have any ideas or thoughts, or could you speak to the increasing digital divide? A lot of what I'm seeing with the technology grants is fantastic. It's really cool. It's really wonderful. The statesidelegal.org, and there's more and more use of technology,
mm-hmm.
but I also feel like we're leaving more and more people behind who don't have access to technology, not just the actual physical computer, but the affordability to pay the fee. A lot of the programs require the higher speed, and then the biggest issue is the training and education to use them properly. So could you just
right? Yeah, I do think that it's a mistake to believe that the internet and sort of high tech stuff generally is a panacea. It's certainly the case that some people can't understand it, let alone afford it, that it's a language that they may not be able to speak. And just as we need to provide language help for people who don't speak English, so that we don't have everything all in one language, so we need to provide assistance, sometimes in the form of human beings, for people who don't speak technese or whatever one would call it. And one of the things we did in my initiative was to meet with Anish Chopra and a number of others. Is that his name? I think it's Anish Chopra in the White House, who's sort of involved in sort of the information technology aspects of what the administration is trying to do with a number of its initiatives, including the healthcare initiative. So all I can say is that I recognize the problem, that it's not enough simply to say we're going to provide computer terminals and software. It's important to make sure that the interface is accessible, that it's not itself too obscure, that people who are just put off by the idea of a keyboard or a screen are recognized as a legitimate subpopulation and get help. But at the same time, there are a lot of people for whom, imperfect though it is, a website or a keyboard in a local cafeteria or library is better than nothing, especially in certain rural areas where we just don't have the human beings to ship out to help people directly, so that it's an imperfect solution, but we shouldn't let the sort of perfect be the enemy of the good. Any other? Yes, Richard?
Excuse me, can I have you speak into the mics of the people outside and on the call here? So if anybody, you know, if out how quiet my voice is. obviously, the President, the Attorney General, creating this position represents, as you indicated, an enormous change in our national attitude to access to justice. Can you suggest anything that can be done to make sure that in the future we continue to have some kind of clear national focus on access to justice, and particularly what LSC can do to try and create some kind of leadership focus going on into the future on some of these issues?
To make sure, I mean, that's a very high order.
Help.
You know, if this had been an office created by statute with a Senate-confirmed position at its head, it might have been more likely that it would have remained, but it might have also been likely that it wouldn't ever have been filled, because, you know, a lot of the people who might be terrific at leading an initiative of this kind are people who are somewhat controversial, are people who have taken positions in the past in favor of access for poor people, which may not be the most popular thing with everybody on the Hill. So I think the best way to increase the probability that an initiative like this doesn't simply vanish after 8 years of the Obama administration, I say that casually, that it doesn't simply vanish is for it to plant its flag all over the place, to plant seeds, to develop constituencies, to develop people with a stake in its continuation, whether they are the state chief justices or the National Center for State Courts or public defenders or, in some instances, prosecutors who can also benefit from more rational and intelligent ways of dealing with some of the people that they process in the course of their professional activities. I think that getting people with a stake in preserving this initiative is really the most important single thing that can be done. But I think that as for what the LSC can do, I really don't know that you have anything much more than your own bully pulpit. That is, the LSC can make clear through speeches by the president, by the chairman of the board, by others, how one doesn't have to be particularly liberal or conservative to see the importance of making access for poor people an element of what we do in this country, to see how much more we spend if poor people are shut out of the system, and how much we can save by making justice more accessible. The more that becomes part of the standard rhetoric, the more likely it is that the next administration will want to keep the initiative going. Yes?
One final question.
I'm Harry Correll. I'm also one of the board members of LSC. And I guess the short version of my question is, how do we avoid reinventing the wheel again and again? I'm going to be co-chairing the pro bono task force with Dean Minow. We're going to be exploring some of the ideas that your office has been exploring. We hear presentations from local grantees and from committees of grantees at our board meetings, where we talk about and they explain to us all of the things they have done to explore the kinds of things that your office is now doing, looking into ways to improve technology to facilitate access to legal services, looking at ways to streamline provision of legal services that don't necessarily require lawyers, exploring mediation, exploring cooperation with state courts. We hear this from grant recipients, we hear it from pro bono committees, we hear it from state courts, and now we hear it from the Department of the Federal Government. And I wonder, how do we capture the work that your organization has now done for the last 10 months and will do for the next 4 or 8 years? How do we capture that at LSC? How do we capture it on the pro bono task force? How do we avoid it just being another pocket of good ideas, but something rather that gets disseminated more broadly so that we can start getting some value out of it?
Wonderful question. And I wish I had an equally wonderful answer. I mean, it seems to me that sort of the deja vu all over again feature of all of this, haven't we heard it before, don't we know what the problems are, is a perennial difficulty whenever one is butting one's head against a wall as thick and as impermeable as the wall of injustice. It seems to me that education, publicity, putting out concise and convincing reports, making sure that they are disseminated in the more elaborate and sort of electronically accessible media that we now have. All of that is rather obvious. I don't have anything to say that is, I mean, you know, if only I had a silver bullet to say this is the way we solve that problem, it would be terrific. But I can't pretend to have it. It seems to me that there are advocates, there are voices out there, people who have been struggling with these problems all their lives, Peter Edelman, Alan Houseman, a number of others, people here, who could speak to that undoubtedly more eloquently and knowledgeably than I can. I was worried about that problem myself. I mean, when I came into the Justice Department, I thought, what else is new? We know that these problems are pervasive, and all I thought I could do, and all I really did, was sort of speak out, try to get buy-in from more groups. I do think that we've made some advance. That is, I think that the state chief justices are more committed now than they were before, partly because when they hear these things said by credible people with concrete examples, and when among them there are people like Robert George, the former chief justice of California, Margie Marshall, the former chief justice of Massachusetts, John Broderick, the former chief justice of New Hampshire, many of them have very powerful presentations about why the state judiciary needs to grab hold of this problem before the problem drags the courts down. In a way, it may be that as the problem becomes more visible, more acute, as it contributes to the overloading of judicial dockets by self-represented litigants who have not received the help that something like the self-representation network that Richard Zorza is so involved in can provide, the closer we come to kind of a boiling point, the more likely it will be that we will somehow break through and get more people to recognize that this is not just someone else's problem, but their own.
For a necessary follow-up,
mm-hmm.
Sure. And simply a suggestion to your office or a request from those of us who are also helping try to solve the problems is, in addition to white papers advocating, would be very helpful, I think, to have white papers summarizing what your office has found. You identified a number of things mm-hmm. that you thought were intriguing. For example, just the sign, I thought it was a great example, unrepresented litigants, two-thirds of whom don't know what that means.
There is a website for the Access to Justice Project that you can easily find if you go to the Department of Justice website. And it does summarize, although with as small a staff as we have, they're rather busier doing things than summarizing what it is that they've done. But I think within a reasonable amount of time, that website will be reasonably updated, and you'll be able to find out what has been done and what they have learned. In fact, it may be more updated now than I'm giving it credit for being. I haven't looked at it for a little while.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So please don't underestimate the power of the 10 months you had, because I believe it's going to live on for many, many years to come, and it's helping to shine a light on a huge national problem. It's not, I know we're right. Please join us for a reception out here.